Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Dan Foster of National Review Online. And for Jim today, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan, the good news today is that if the election were to be held today, which it's not, it's almost a year away, but if the election were to be held today, at least in New Hampshire, Mitt Romney would be a 10-point winner over President Obama. Now, I guess the caveat is that New Hampshire is probably his strongest state, and there is a 5.5 percentage margin of error here, but it's 50-40, which means the president's not doing very well in a state he won pretty handily four years ago. And Romney, even though he's lapping the Republican field, is also pretty strong against Obama. And I think for a guy that would expect to be stronger than perhaps some of the other GOP rivals in the Rust Belt, I think that's a pretty good sign. And in a live free or die state, it means they're kind of accepting of him. That's got to be good, even though I know a lot of conservatives, myself included, still aren't completely sold.
I think the key to winning in 2012, Greg, is going to be you have to roll back Obama's advances on the 2008 map. You have to make the map look more like presidential maps have looked for the last 20 years in terms of locking down the middle of the country and rolling Obama back in North Carolina and maybe, you know, even Virginia. Obviously, every election is decided by the person who – I say obviously, someone's going to check this and it's not going to be true. but the conventional wisdom, you know, the thing that I always operate on is you have to win 2 out of 3 of Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. All those states are going to be really interesting and I think really competitive. We put up some polls of head-to-head matchups between Obama and either a generic Republican or it might have been Romney.
Some would say there's not much difference.
Which is, they're interchangeable, right? But we put up some polls last week about those three states in particular, and Romney / generic Republican are in statistical ties with Obama in those three states, and that's a lot of electoral votes at play. So one thing that Romney would bring to the table, although I think New Hampshire is really the only state where it could operate, maybe Maine, is that he brings some credibility as a Republican to New England. You might be able to force the Democrats to put more resources up there, the Obama campaign to put more resources up there, and kind of bring New England into play a little bit. Even if you don't win all those states that are gettable, you maybe at least make them spend a little more money up there. That's a Garrity question, obviously. I take his take on it more than my own. But it's good to see Romney doing that. The thing that you see in all the polls is that supporters of candidates to Romney's right are really just sort of angry about the prospect of voting for Romney in a general if he becomes the nominee. But I think they'll show up and they will vote for Romney. The reverse doesn't hold. I think Romney's fans might not show up, especially in a state like New Hampshire. That's what I thought when I saw this poll. Romney fans might not show up if the candidate is somebody a lot farther to the right. You know, a lot of Romney's fans are those, that dying breed, the moderate Northeast Republican.
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of those, at least elected recently. So hopefully that'll change not only there, but we can get some Republicans elected to other statewide offices, Senate and House seats up there. It's been pretty bleak lately with the exception of Scott Brown. So we'll see if there's any coattails, if in fact Romney can win the nomination and actually hold on to that sort of margin. So a lot of ifs, but still a little glimmer that provides a little hope for the GOP in New Hampshire. On to martini number two now, and I don't think anybody's going to be shocked by our bad martini today, Dan, and no one's shocked that what the news is, and that's $15 trillion in debt the United States is, and right now the super committee is trying to figure out how to reduce the increase in spending over the next 10 years by $1.2 trillion when that's not even a 1 year's deficit right now. So a lot of optimism going on, I'm sure, around the country with that. And, you know, you think about what's happening here. Jim pointed out a few months ago that as horrific as the deficit spending of the Bush administration was, and you'll wait the rest of your life to hear me defend the Bush administration on fiscal discipline, Obama, in less than 4 years, create more in deficits than the Bush administration did in 8 years. He's got more red ink already.
The real bottom line, too, if you want to really be scared, is not just the $15 trillion, but the total present value of our unfunded liabilities to all of the entitlement programs and all the money that we've guaranteed we'd spend over the, you know, next 30 years is something like $116 trillion. Ugh. So if you really, so we're getting quickly to the point where the debt's not going to matter simply because there's nobody who can conceive of numbers that big. So you know, maybe that'll be a good thing when we get to that point. But
right.
In the context of that, this $1.2 trillion reduction, as you put it, in the increased rate of spending as a drop in the bucket. And around here, there's the kind of doomsday brigade led by Mark Stein and others that really we shouldn't care, because I don't think I'm putting words in his mouth, but essentially one day our creditors will show up. The bill will be due, and it'll all be over. So he doesn't put any stock in our political ability to prevent this from happening. He just sort of sits back, relaxes, and waits for the inevitable. And usually I think, no, Mark, you know, we should really be doing everything we can to whip Washington into shape and get and make real cuts happen and come back from the fiscal brink. But the more and more I think about it, the more and more I think he's right. it's just going to take, you know, our bills coming due and some sort of catastrophic event for us to finally understand that we can't afford this lifestyle that we've grown accustomed to.
Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow the Chinese will come to collect their bill. Yeah,
that's right.
That's very, very heartwarming as we head into the holiday season here. A lot of people, of course, think that the government's not spending enough, Dan, and we've been talking about them all week, hopefully not ad nauseum to our listeners, but that's the Occupy crowd up on Wall Street in D.C. Today's their big day up on Wall Street. They decided to wear suits and blend in with the Wall Street crowd, and then they just started jumping into intersections and yelling stuff because that'll change policy. And here in D.C., they're threatening to ruin several thousand people's commute, mine as well, by occupying the Key Bridge from Georgetown into Northern Virginia. So that ought to be thrilling this evening. But you don't get a lot of people anymore saying what they really believe and what really is kind of the truth here when it comes to the Occupy Wall Streeters. Eric Cantor called them a mob in otherwise pretty tame language, and people jumped all over him. Fortunately, Peter King's from New York. And he's used to just kind of saying what he thinks. And he was on Bloomberg TV with an anchor who was just totally out of her league on this, thinking that you know, these people have legitimate grievances and so forth. Here's a couple of clips from Peter King. Here's the first one about what Occupy Wall Street is all about.
First of all, you try to listen to them and they make almost no sense. These are people who are living in dirt. These were people who were involved with drugs. There were violence. There was rape. You're talking about a small number of people. You probably get more people in a mass in St. Patrick's Cathedral on Sunday than you got in Zuccotti Park. I think the media has made a terrible mistake in somehow romanticizing and giving these people credibility.
And so then the anchorwoman says, but these people, a lot of them, you know, most of them aren't raping people. They have legitimate grievances. So what do you have to say to their concerns about jobs and the state of the economy? Here's Peter King again.
What are they proposing as far as tax reform? What are they talking about job growth? What are they talking about government down on government regulations? What are they talking about as far as expanding trade? Nothing. They're angry people. They're angry people who are losers, who are on the outside and screaming.
Well, there you go. I think that pretty much sums it up. He's got a good point. They really have no concrete ideas other than that they hate that other people have more money than them. In fact, well, a lot of them have parents who are in the 1%, but that notwithstanding, they pretty much have, as we've explained all week, devolved into something that's not even really civilized anymore. And they're basically just out there to create havoc because they really don't have any good ideas. And kudos to Peter King for finally cutting to the chase.
Yeah, losers who live in the dirt. He summed it all up right there. Yeah, so I've suggested this earlier in the week, and I have this theory that the course of American history is basically determined by one working soccer mother somewhere in rural Indiana who goes to church on Sundays. She's the median American. She is middle America. She goes to church on Sundays. She goes to PTA meetings. She's got a couple of kids. She has a part-time job, and she drives a minivan. And she, who determines the future of our country, who does she look at and see as more like herself? A Tea Party protester, somebody who puts on a tri-cornered hat, goes to a rally, like I said, but you know what, goes after he gets out of work and then picks up his kids from soccer practice when he's done, or this, you know, dreadlocked, trustafarian, grimy, dirty, overeducated, underinformed set that constitutes Occupy Wall Street? I think the answer to that is clear, and you see it in the polling, and frankly, middle America just doesn't. They initially tolerated broad outlines of the Occupy Wall Street message because it's something that resonates with a lot of people. Is that, you know, we don't like the bailout culture, we don't like the idea that Wall Street's misbehavior was subsidized by the federal government, continues to be subsidized by the federal government. We don't like crony capitalism, and you know what? 99% of Americans do agree on that. The question is what comes after that, and we've seen with Occupy Wall Street, it's very little, and what little there is really bad.
It's again coming to light, as we've explained all week, and the restraint shown by the police up in New York has just been admirable to the nth degree, how they're really trying to allow these people to demonstrate as much as possible until they just absolutely go over the line. So again, hats off to the cops. You'll never hear that from the actual protesters, so we'll say it. Dan, thanks for being with us again today, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Dan Foster of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.